many as 24% of females and close to 8% of males in Canada. So it's not trivial. There are many forms of migraine, but there are three quite common forms. The first is nowadays called migraine without aura, used to be called common migraine. Second is migraine with aura, or formerly classical migraine. And the third form, which I bet there are some of you in the room who have but don't know it, is something that these days is now called migraine with aura without headache, used to be called acephalgic migraine. And this actually doesn't usually get figured into the epidemiological studies, so the actual number of people who have one of these three things is probably higher than what I showed you a moment ago. So this is just an illustration of a migraine episode to place the aura in it, which is what I'm actually going to talk about. So while, as I said, people tend to be aware of migraine headache, the headache is really only part of a more complicated syndrome, and the pattern leading up to a headache consists of a variety of prodromal symptoms, things that lead people to sort of suspect this is about to happen. And then in some cases there's what's called an aura, which is what I'm going to focus on in a moment, leading to the headache, and this is accompanied by all sorts of other symptoms, including both phonophobia and photophobia, meaning a painful experience of both light and sound, sound and light, also of smells often, and accompanied by nausea, vomiting, and various other unpleasant characteristics. And then as this resolves, people recover. This whole process can take up to about 72 hours. That's the outer limit, but about 8 to 72 hours. And of course, a great deal of biomedical research these days is aimed at stopping this part, stopping the headache. Much less attention has been paid to the aura, which people consider to be benign, although I'm not entirely in agreement with that. So a migraine aura is a transient neurological disturbance. It can consist of either positive or negative symptoms, and what I mean by those will become clear when I talk about visual auras. Visual auras are the most common form of aura. About 90% of auras are visual auras. But there are other kinds of auras as well. These include somatosensory auras, people feeling either numbness or tingling somewhere on their skin. There are reports of olfactory auras. There are some speech-related auras where people lose either the capacity to produce speech or to comprehend it. And then there's a quite unique form of migraine where there are motor symptoms. Okay, so I said there's a major visual component to migraine. The aura is the most striking aspect of this, although as I pointed out earlier, not everybody gets auras. In fact, probably about 30% of the people who have headaches get auras, somewhere between 10 and 40. People who have migraine, all of them have photophobia during the headache. So people with migraine classically go and hide in a dark room, put their head under a pillow. And the other thing I've been working on is the fact that many people with migraine also have abnormal visual function interictally, that is during the period when they're not having a migraine episode, although it's of some debate right now whether these abnormal visual characteristics reflect the underlying process of migraine, that is, you have minor abnormalities in your vision because you have migraine, or whether they're a result of the migraine, that is, whether repeated migraine episodes can actually affect your visual system. That's a topic for another day, but that is something we're interested in. Now, what is a visual aura? Well, a visual aura can take many forms, actually. Some people see flashing spots. Some people merely have a blind area or a scotoma, which can actually be a whole half of the visual field. But the most frequently described and well described in the literature type of aura is what you see here. It's usually called a fortification aura. And this is an example provided by Carl Lashley, the neuropsychologist, early neuropsychologist, who drew his own auras. And in fact, most of our good cases are of people drawing their own auras. And what this shows is what he saw in his visual field. It's light-dark reverse. So what he saw was flashing bright lights on a whatever the background. Proceeding across his visual field, the times are in minutes. So this is at when he first noticed it was right near the fixation point. X is always the fixation point. So it's drifting out across the visual field, and it's followed by an area that's indicated here of scotoma, or an area where you don't see anything. Well, you may not be completely aware of that unless you actually test it. Now, I'm going to show you a little schematic illustration of an aura, but what you're going to see takes about 2 seconds to go, or less than that, a second to go across the screen. If you were having one of these, it would take about 25 minutes. So this is a very slow-moving process going across your visual field. And, oh, sorry, it did not work. There. I don't know why. Maybe you're not going to get to see that. I guess we'll have to let that go. But anyway, what happens... I did. It just isn't doing it. So I can show people afterwards if you want to see it. But basically what happens is this moves slowly across your visual field, and as it moves, it's also scintillating or flickering. And these are some artistic impressions of auras drawn by artists, so that gives you some impression of what people have experienced superimposed on an image. Now, the actual characteristics of these fortification auras are that they usually consist of positive features, meaning that you're seeing something that isn't there as opposed to you're not seeing something that is there, followed by a scotoma, which is a blind area. Your impression is that they're binocular. Now, that's, of course, very hard to test. They affect one hemifield, usually. That is, it usually stops exactly at the vertical meridian and does not go into the other hemifield, although occasionally people have auras that are in one field and then have one in the other field. It usually begins centrally and moves into the periphery, although I'm going to show you some cases where that isn't true. And they're often continuous across the horizontal meridian, meaning that it's not just limited to your upper field or your lower field, and that the zigzag line you see goes smoothly across the horizontal. Now, why are all these things important? Well, they all suggest that, first of all, this is a cortical phenomenon. The fact that it splits at the vertical meridian certainly suggests that it's beyond the optic chiasm. The fact that the components are line elements strongly suggests that it has a cortical basis, because that's the first level in the visual pathway at which we see receptive fields that are oriented. And the fact that it actually crosses the horizontal meridian is quite important, because if you look at the maps of the visual field as they're mapped into the visual cortex, there are only a couple of those many cortical representations. The visual field is represented many times over in the brain, but there are only two of those representations that I know of in which there is a continuous representation across the horizontal. All the others are split at the horizontal meridian, so that the upper visual fields appear in the lower part of the brain and the lower visual fields appear in the upper part of the brain. So if you want a process that is going to be smooth across the whole map, you would presumably want to look in one of those places where the map is continuous, which led us and others to consider the striate cortex, V1, as the most likely source of this. Now, what kind of process would underlie such an event? Well, it was clear to Lashley back in 1941 that this was some sort of spreading neural activation followed by neural suppression. He didn't quite know what it was. Turned out that just about exactly the same time, Liao was describing a phenomenon he'd found called cortical spreading depression, which is exactly that. Cortical spreading depression is a phenomenon where there's a wave front of depression or complete turning off of neural activity, but at the wave front there's a burst of cortical activation first. And that was described very well back in the 1940s. It was researched for a while then, and in fact the connection between that and migraine was made by Peter Milner in the 1950s. But people forgot about it for the next about 30 years, and it's only been in the last maybe 20 years, 15, 20 years, that the interest in the connection between spreading depression and migraine has once again come to the fore. There is quite a lot of suggestive evidence that something like spreading depression is what's going on. This is work from blood flow studies done by Lauritsen and Olson, showing that during a migraine aura, there is a gradual spreading of a reduced blood flow that goes from, if I can get a pointer, from the back of the brain gradually forward. Now, this is how we study auras. My part of this is to actually collect data on auras, and Hugh's part is to figure out how to model it. So we've done quite a bit of work. This was work I did at McGill, actually, before I moved to Toronto, having people map their auras as they happen. The other approach would be to try to actually image them in a scanner, and somebody has now done that, but the trade-off is that we can have people image do many auras, and they do it at home. So basically, what happens is we train people, as you see here, to set themselves up in front of our maps that we give them at a fixed viewing distance, which we have an arrangement with a string so that they're always at the right distance. They're trained to fixate the central spot. And while they're doing that, to trace what they're seeing in their visual field at 5-minute intervals. And the sort of thing we get doesn't show up very well, but in our maps like this, that you can see the tracings that this individual has made. And if they're a good subject, I remember to put the times on it because you need that. Then what we've done is to use the Horton and Hoyt map of striate cortex and basically project their maps into cortical coordinates to see where each of those aura lines would be on the cortex at a particular time when they saw it. So this would be the representation of the first of those lines in striate cortex and so on. I don't know why I'm losing my voice, but for those of you who are not visual cortex aficionados, you probably noted that the first line up there is very tiny, occupies a very small space, but it actually occupies a very large space here. That's because the mapping of the visual field into the visual cortex is not equal everywhere, but it's very greatly expanded in the fovea and becomes progressively less space devoted as you go out into the periphery. It's the so-called cortical magnification factor. Oh, these are millimeters, right? Yeah. And, oh, sorry. Yes. I have different variants of it, so.
Those are millimeters. The outside boundary is the vertical meridian, the horizontal meridian.
Yes, I should have explained a little more. Yeah, okay. So. Yes, well, Hugh can tell you about that part in a moment, but basically, yes, the vertical meridian, I should have explained this to non-vision people, the vertical meridian actually goes all the way around there, so the visual field is laid out in such a way that the vertical is right around there. The fovea is here, and it occupies a very large part of this end, so this 2 degrees would be out about here. So. And this only goes out to about 30 degrees in the field. We didn't map the whole thing. Oh, thank you very much. Yes. All right, so this is data from a whole set of auras that we have mapped from several different individuals and numerous episodes, and the different colors indicate that some of them were in the left visual field and others were in the right visual field, but we've collapsed them all onto a single map. So, and what you can see is that they have a tendency to start near the fovea and move out into the periphery, although there are clear exceptions, ones that actually started somewhere else, and a few that take rather peculiar courses. But by and large, they move relatively relatively stereotyped pattern. Sometimes they only appear further out. They don't always start right near the fovea, although there's always the problem of did the subject actually start mapping at exactly the right time. You always lose a bit at the beginning because, of course, it takes them a few minutes to get set up. Now, John. No, yes, each line is a different aura. So each of those lines represents the whole set of things that I showed you before. I took a map like I showed you a moment ago and created one line to represent that. We've also looked at things like the speed of travel as it progresses, which is what I'm going to show you next. That's, of course, part of the point. The average rate of spread, if you look at those maps, turned out to be about 2 millimeters a minute. Now, there's a couple caveats here. We used a standardized map from Horton and Hoyt. We know that human V1 has quite a lot of variability in its overall size. So these numbers could be off by about a factor of 2. Nevertheless, this puts this squarely into the kind of time frame that has been reported in experimental studies of spreading depression in rats and rabbits and other species. The other thing we've looked at is the rate at which these auras appear to flicker or scintillate. They flicker, they roll, they flash. Different people use different descriptions, but they're not static. Now, we studied this by building a little box with a light-emitting diode in it that flickered at a frequency which could be adjusted by the subject. I'm indebted to Joel Picorni at Chicago for actually this idea. And so what the subjects did, since the aura is in one visual field, while they were having an aura, this all happens at home, they had this little box which they turn on. They're watching this thing happen in one visual field, and at the same time they're matching it in the other visual field. And it turned out that people were quite reliable at doing that. Each of these colors represents a different individual, and each symbol is a different aura. You could see that the flicker rates ranged from just under 10 hertz, in most cases up to about 25. We had one exceptional subject who claimed to see auras flickering at around 40 hertz. That's getting fairly close to the flicker fusion limit, so I'm a little bit skeptical of her data, but she was certainly consistent in what she told us. But the average worked out to be somewhere around 17 hertz. So that gives you a little bit of background on aura phenomenology. And so what we've done with that is to go on and try to create a model that would capture some of these properties. And I'm going to turn this over to Hugh and let him tell you about that.
By the way, does anyone have a laser pointer? Okay, well, what I'm going to do is try and I can probably fill the room without this, by the way. Is that okay? I'm used to filling classrooms without. I'm going to present a simple but first stage, if you like, biophysical neural model of what we think is going on in migraine. It captures many of the aspects of the different types of auras that Fran has described. In the literature, there have been 4 different factors that have been suggested to cause auras. The first is increased extracellular potassium, and you can show from anything from the Hodgkin-Huxley equations on to more realistic equations for human neurons that as you change extracellular potassium, you shift, of course, the equilibrium potential to the point where neurons become spontaneously active. And if you shift it too far, they then lose the ability to fire spikes, so you have one regime where they can become spontaneously active, followed by a regime where they shut down. Second thing that's been suggested is decreased extracellular magnesium, which, given the presence of recurrent excitatory NMDA receptors in primary visual cortex, would lead effectively to unblocking NMDA receptors, therefore effectively strengthening recurrent excitation in the cortex. As you can see, these are all functionally positive feedback loops, increasing excitability. The third, of course, is the decreased inhibition, which would tend, therefore, to enhance excitability as, if you like, a rebound. And finally, and I'll come to these currents in a moment, it turns out that all excitatory neocortical neurons that have been studied, either in mammals or in humans, and there's a fair amount of human data taken from healthy tissue removed as part of usually temporal lobe epilepsy operations, but tissue away from the epileptic focus. All of these have currents that tend to self-adapt the neuron. They're typically either sodium-mediated potassium currents and second messengers, so they're very slow, or they're calcium-mediated potassium currents. Some of them having time constants up to 3 or 4 seconds. So very slow on neural time scales. These, however, are under control of neuromodulators like serotonin. Excess serotonin reduces the effect of these currents, thereby also increasing excitability. So the first thing I need to do is show you a simple model for human neocortical neurons that I devised. It's a two-compartment model based on work by Renzel et al. So there's a compartment for a dendrite where I'll put all of the excitatory input coupled by resistance to a separate compartment for the soma where the inhibitory inputs arrive and where spikes are generated. The excitatory neurons have these slow, this is after hyperpolarizing. I'll show you again data on that in a moment. And I've simplified these equations in a conductive space way that actually captures, this is just a general form, you don't have to worry about the time constant, but you can think of this as a sodium conductance that is accelerating due to the quadratic nonlinearity, multiplied by the difference between the membrane potential and the equilibrium potential for sodium. This would be a potassium conductance obeying its own equation, multiplied by the difference between the membrane potential and the potassium equilibrium potential. These actually, although they're only cubic, as for those of you who know these models, the Fitzhugh-Nagumo or Hindmarsh-Rose equations, because they obey conduction dynamics, they are surprisingly accurate, both in the waveform and the spike rate for human neurons, and I'll show you that in a moment. First of all, though, the way in which these generate action potentials is through a saddle node bifurcation. If you look at the isocline, remember I'm the math half of this talk, so I'm assuming that most of these terms are reasonably familiar or old hat, maybe. You have the DVDT isocline, which is like this, and it's no longer per cubic because of the conduction dynamics. It's distorted in the same way that the equivalent isocline is for Hodgkin-Huxley equations and so forth. This is the isocline for the basic potassium conductance, and you've got a node, a saddle point, and an unstable spiral point. When you inject current, basically this curve and this lobe of this curve moves up so that the saddle node goes through a bifurcation, leading to limit cycles around the spiral point. This is the way in which it generates action potentials. It begins at a spike rate of arbitrarily low, as do cortical neurons, but this is the characteristic that the Hodgkin-Huxley equations lack, because they lack additional currents that are present in humans. This shows the shape of a couple of action potentials. This is at a rate of 20 spikes a second, and just to show you that these are pretty good fits to human data. These are actual data on the excitatory action potential of a human neocortical neuron, taken, I believe, from Furing's work. this is the action potential shape from the model, which is, as I said, just has cubic dynamics, but actually provides quite a good fit. Next, let me show you slight frequency adaptation. This is from a model, but I'll show you data in a moment. The point is that excitatory neurons in the cortex, if you give them a constant current input, begin firing at a high rate, namely spikes close together, and over the course of a few hundred milliseconds, the rate typically drops by about a factor of 3. If you plot that at instantaneous spike rate, you get that for a model, and these are data on a human neuron. I'm sorry this didn't digitize too well, but you can see this one, for example, it's starting at a rate up there, and over the course of about 250 milliseconds, it's dropped to this asymptotic level. This is a self-adapting current, as they say, typically either sodium or calcium-mediated potassium currents. Slow time constant, and it's controlled by all the known neuromodulators, dopamine, serotonin, histamine, acetylcholine, all of which reduce this adapting effect. So obviously too much of one of these transmitters would lead to an increase in asymptotic firing level, which would be another functional form of enhanced excitability. Just to show you that this model neuron does a very nice job with firing rates, here are data on a human neuron. The initial firing rate is a function of the current in nanoamps, and the steady state firing rate. And the model does a pretty good job, at least up to moderately high levels of firing. So what I'm going to do now is put these model neurons into a network with properties of aspects of primary visual cortex and show you that by manipulating these four factors I've talked about, we can reproduce many aspects, I hope ultimately all aspects, of aura behavior. The way in which they're interconnected, the excitatory neurons have two compartments, a dendrite with resistance coupling to a soma. There are recurrent NMDA receptor-mediated coupling between or among the excitatory neurons. The excitatory neurons, in turn, via AMPA receptors, activate an inhibitory neuron, which is modeled as just a single compartment in this case, which via GABA synapses provides inhibition directly to the cell bodies of the excitatory neurons. In addition, we model external potassium, which is one of the factors I talked about, in terms of uptake by astrocytes. And there are calculations in the literature that we've used that estimate how much potassium is released per action potential. By the way, there's also evidence that the uptake by astrocytes is much faster than the sodium-potassium pump, so over the time courses we're interested in, we can ignore the other reasonably well. The actual modules we used had 4 excitatory neurons and 1 inhibitory, because that is the correct percentage for primary visual cortex. Studies have reported that approximately 80% of the cells in V1 are excitatory and 20% inhibitory. So those are the proportions that we took. Okay, with all of the parameters that I've alluded to, the uptake rate of extracellular potassium, the extracellular magnesium, the GABA inhibitory strength, and the level of the self-adaptation in a normal range based upon the available data, you get what you would expect. You turn on a stimulus for 100 milliseconds, you activate the excitatory neurons that are receiving the input, they in turn activate the inhibitory neuron, you turn off the stimulus and everything shuts off. So it's a nice stimulus-blocked response that does not extend past the end of the stimulus. If you start playing with these parameters, there are 2 regimes I'm going to show you that we've discovered that seem to correspond very nicely to two different types of auras. If you simply increase the extracellular potassium by reducing the uptake rate, the uptake rate is highly variable dependent upon the amount of extracellular potassium released, according to the literature. You can produce a regime where you produce neural activity, but only following the stimulus, only ongoing activity in the inhibitory neurons, which remains strong enough to silence the excitatory neurons until eventually it drives the extracellular potassium up to the level where the inhibitory neuron shuts off, there's a quick burst, and then the entire system shuts down. This, with different parameters, can lead to inhibitory firing for up to about 19 seconds continuously before self shutdown. So what this would be interpreted as, if you were the visual observer or if you had a migraine, would be purely as a scotoma, because these are interneurons which are preventing essentially any information from going to higher cortical areas. So one of the important messages, I think, is that you can have a scotoma in the presence of very rapid neural activity if the neural activity happens to be an inhibitory interneuron. So the type of aura that may be exclusively a scotoma, which is the less common type, would map, we think, onto this type of dynamical behavior. Okay, I'm now going to switch for a moment and show you a couple of demos of the other regime, which leads to bursting, and in this case, I think, unfortunately, that the results go off the slide a little bit because my screen has higher resolution than I'm actually running these simulations. The screen of my computer has higher resolution than the projector, and so it's simply taking a subset of my screen to project. But the point is, in this case, where I manipulated external potassium uptake, reduced external magnesium, reduced self-adaptation, and reduced inhibition briefly, following a stimulus that stopped here, the system spontaneously goes into bursting behavior. These are the excitatory neurons. This is inhibitory. This burst rate averages about 5 or 6 hertz. And you can see, however, that the intervals are uneven. We're almost certain this is chaotic because there's no noise per se in the model. I simply haven't had a chance to do the appropriate mathematical tests for chaos yet, but that's coming up. Now let me show you what happens if you run that for a longer period of time. This will take about 16 seconds to run. I'm going to show you that that bursting behavior continues for about 25 seconds in the simulation and then shuts itself off because the external potassium builds up to the point where you go through a second bifurcation and the neurons can no longer, it's going off the screen, I'm sorry. Take my word for it, it shuts off about there on the blackboard. And I can show that to anyone during the break when we have the full screen resolution. Again, you can see the evidence. This is all certainly chaotic. This is not, even though this is a totally deterministic model and the stimulus has stopped here, the burst intervals are quasi-unpredictable. We have to look at that. So in this regime, what we found that to get this bursting behavior, we need increased extracellular potassium, reduced extracellular magnesium. These are factors that have been reported in the literature. Modestly reduced inhibition and reduced strength of this other current. You need, apparently, to have all of these come together to produce this type of bursting. And this is very important because these neurons do not by themselves burst. This is a network property. And it's a system that, after all, is not set up to burst when it's functioning normally. When you see a constant visual stimulus, you do not see it as fluctuating or flickering. However, the positive aspects of migraine aura do have this flickering behavior that we capture. And the inhibitory requires just a large, a significantly larger extracellular potassium buildup. Now this part, I won't show you the demo. Actually, I'll run the demo of this afterwards for people who are interested, because you need the whole screen to see it. We've coupled these modules, which have four excitatory neurons that are mutually interconnected and connected to an inhibitory neuron for feedback. We've coupled these in a chain, and the individual compartments in the chain are coupled by NMDA synapses, which would simulate collinear facilitation. In primary visual cortex, neurons that have the same preferred orientation and are roughly collinear, but spatially disparate, are connected by long-range but weak synapses, excitatory synapses. And the other way in which the compartments are connected is via extracellular potassium diffusion. In this model, the only way you can get a traveling wave is with both of these factors. There have been a few previous migraine models that have only focused on this and have ignored the neurons, or just said, well, the neurons are an epiphenomenon feeding off the diffusion. We find that both processes are necessary to get traveling waves. As I say, I won't show you the demo of this. I'll show it during the break. We get this bursting near 5 or 6 hertz, which is somewhere at the lower end of the human data, but I can talk about that in the questions if you like. And a chain of these produces an approximate speed if you assume that the individual modules are one ocular dominance column apart, which is sort of the repeat distance of cortical machinery. And that's approximately a millimeter in humans. It produces a speed of 2.5 millimeters a minute traveling across the cortex. And that's been one of the challenges in explaining migraine, because this is an extraordinarily slow speed by any reasonable neural standard. This is why it takes 25 to 40 minutes to cross the entire visual field, which is about 8 centimeters long. So, conclusions. We believe that multiple factors have to come together to cause the flashing, traveling auras in migraine. And this is a consequence of neural modeling. If you look at the experimental literature, one paper will say, oh, it's all magnesium, another will say, oh, it's all potassium, and so forth. We believe that it's a constellation of factors. You can also get two types of auras, which are reported in the literature, in different dynamical regimes. And these chains produce the appropriate speed of wave propagation, again with the assumption, for which there's anatomical evidence, that the longest range connections are roughly between cortical